You're listening to Cross the Border. That's the name of this program. And today we're going through the book of Daniel. Right now we're discussing the four beasts of Daniel chapter 7. Specifically, we're talking about the fourth beast right now. And from history and all the evidence we have, it's pretty much settled that this fourth beast is the Roman Empire. And so we're talking about details of the Roman Empire. We're talking about, I'm going to have to back up here a little bit. We're talking about, we're talking about the little horn, or the talking horn that rose up, and the papal power over other bishops and the power to punish heresy was given to the Pope as a matter of legal right in the spring of 538 A.D., after Justinian's general Belisarius managed to break the siege of Rome by the Ostrogoths, which lasted from March of 537 to 538. Belisarius first entered Rome in December of 536 when the Ostrogoths abandoned Rome as he entered it. But he had to immediately begin preparation for the siege that he knew was coming, and facing an enemy with probably 10 times as many troops. This would leave him little time for setting up and running Roman law administration. So consequently, it is extremely probable that he did not get that done. And, you know, we're talking about history here, and what we're talking about is the historicist interpretation of prophecy, and that is that prophecy unfolds in history. I know this doesn't jibe with the Jesuit invented prophecy model called futurism, which is widely accepted today. So we know where that came from, because we know who influenced that teaching that is so popular today, because we know where it came from. We know who originated it. The historicist interpretation of prophecy was held historically by the early church and by the reformers, and still, I believe, is our most reliable source for prophecy. So, let's continue here. Once the siege began, virtually nobody could leave the city, so any laws that Justinian had made that were to be generally applicable and enforceable outside the city by the Pope or anybody else were simply not enforceable. You can't enforce a law that you cannot get a message out about, nor can you enforce a law that you cannot back up with the force of arms. They, Belisarius and the Pope, could get messages out, but could not mount significant force of arms to back up what was ordered. So it was a toothless law. Once the siege of the Ostrogoths was lifted, the decree of 533 AD by Justinian making the Pope supreme bishop and giving him power to punish heresy was implemented and enforceable by law. And you can look that up, decree of Justinian in 533 AD if you want to search that out. One interesting point about the siege of the Ostrogoths against Rome is what happened to weaken the Ostrogothic army. The Ostrogoths cut the aqueducts supplying Rome with water, expecting that without water, the city would give up in a matter of days. But as it happens, the people of the city made do with the water that was already available in Rome itself. The act of cutting the aqueduct turned against the Ostrogoths because they could not stop the flow of water through the aqueducts, and could only divert the water elsewhere. This water collected in ponds that bred mosquitoes, which in turn became infected with malaria parasites, which then bit the Ostrogothic soldiers, thereby infecting them with malaria. This essentially defeated the Ostrogoths and made them so weak that Rome was able to fend them off, and they finally had to give up. One can only surmise if this event eventually played a large role in the final defeat and dissolution of the Ostrogoths some 16 or 18 years later. At this point in time, all three factors necessary to enforce the decree were in place. One, Justinian's government controlled Rome, and two, they, Belisarius and the Pope, could now send messages to and from the outside world, and three, and back it up, what they ordered with the force of arms. Thus it was, this decree became enforceable in March of 538 A.D. This power lasted until 1798, when Napoleon's general Berthier invaded Rome, and on the 15th of February that year wrote a decree ending the powers of the papal government, which officially ended the power the Pope had over other governments and religious authorities. Now, that didn't end the papacy, but its power was crippled after and it no longer had power over all the other bishops to punish whatever it considered heresy. And if you'll notice, that was about 1260 years, from 538 A.D. to 1798 A.D. So we have history backing up prophecy. So if you want to know where the 1268 years comes in, there it is. And it's the power of the little horn, or the talking horn, that he had over the saints. Now, some would argue that nothing significant happened in 538 A.D., but that is untrue. It is recognized by historians that the Pope consolidated his powers in Rome in the year 538 A.D. and not before. It is from this point in time that the setup of the Church with the powers it would have for the next 1260 years was created, not later. The power of the Church began to grow some from this point in time as well. Further, it gave the Pope powers he did not have before, so that he could control the Church from his post in Rome. It also removed the direct control of the Ostrogoths as a force opposing the Pope, for they were Arians and were opposed to papal power because of the beliefs they had. It also prepared the way for Pope Gregory, who came along in the late 6th century, to be able to greatly consolidate and concentrate papal power, which further enabled him to reorganize the Church. All of these things tie back into the events of 538. Without that event, none of these things would have been possible. So a decree created the power that the Bible recognizes the Pope got his beginning, that power, by decree in 538 AD, and 1260 years later, almost to the month, Napoleon's army undid this by decree. Very interesting. And here's an excellent further documentation, so you can look that up for yourself if you want more documentation on that. It's all out there, it's all history. And so we see that prophecy has unfolded in history. So I'm just hoping to pull a lot of people away from this futurist interpretation of history, which is nonsensical. And we can't see it unfolding in history because it's all future. There's this huge void between the time that the Messiah, Yahshua, or Jesus, as most people in the West call him, was crucified, and up till now, you know, it's silent. It's all silent. There's nothing. And but we see all of this unfolding if we open our eyes to what the Scripture really says and apply all of these logical principles. So how do we know that the decree is what defined the 1260 years? Daniel 7:25 says, "And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time, times, and the dividing of time." The phrase, "and they shall give into his hand until a time, times, and the dividing of time," tells you that during the 1260 years, the people of God would be given into the hands of the talking horn. And how are they given into his hands? Who gave them into his hand? Justinian, by a simple decree, which gave the Pope the power to punish heresy. This allowed the Pope to decide what was heresy without any oversight by anyone else. His word was law without question. Historically, it is known that the papacy did engage in some persecution before 538 AD, but after that, it was explicitly legal for them to do this. So the people of God were literally given into the hand of this power by decree. That combined with the identity of the talking horn, other places typically refer to this power as the little horn. The obvious historical fact that they had legal power for 1260 years, almost down to the month, is reasonable evidence that the years 538 AD to 1798 AD constitute the 1260 years based on the decree, on the decrees, one beginning and one ending to the year. We know the events of 1798 down to the very day each of them occurred on, so we can, in fact, work backwards from that to approximate date of the events of 538. We don't have to do that because we have sufficient knowledge of what happened in 538 to know roughly when the decree of Justinian became enforceable. But it is nice to know that we can work backwards if needed. And that way we can check out a lot of different things, like Daniel's 70 weeks. We can go backwards from the time that the Messiah was cut off and go back and date Daniel correctly. So, continue. Yahuwah, our Heavenly Father, our Creator, seems to often go by decrees in judging human events, especially in the matters of prophecy in Daniel and Revelation. Consider that Daniel 9:25 says, "Know therefore and understand from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 72 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublous times." So we have a decree here, and the 7 weeks doesn't mean weeks. It means 70 sevens. But we'll get into that when we get to Daniel chapter 9. Now, there's a saying that absolute power corrupts absolutely, and it certainly has proved to be true. History shows the result of this, for unknown numbers of people were killed on the orders of the popes during this time period. If you doubt that, consider that Pope John Paul II has admitted that they persecuted and killed many, and he apologized for the errors of the past popes in doing this. Catholic protagonists argue that only a few heretics were killed, which statements history does not support, as a lot more than just a few were killed. But even if the statement were true, which it is not, what if you were one of those few heretics who was burned at the stake for your beliefs? How would you feel about it? God says that what he thinks about in Daniel 7:26, he says about this talking horn, "But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end." So those who do these things will receive their punishment. Remember that Yahshua said, "And they shall put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think that he doeth God service." This indicates that there would come a time when people would be killed by those who think they are doing God a service, which is not unlike the murders done by terrorists on September 11th, and we see it going on today. These people believe that they're doing a service to God. This horn did certain other things that can be used to identify it. It is believed to have been influential in causing three tribes that opposed the papacy to be destroyed. This does not mean that it was directly responsible, just that it had an influence with regards to these events. It is not known exactly which 10 powers the 10 horns represent, but the 10 most influential in Europe are the ones typically proposed, as these eventually evolved into the major nations of Europe that we see today. Here are the 10 tribes and the nations that evolved into what are commonly proposed. Anglo-Saxons, that would be England, the Alemanni, Germany, Burgundians, Switzerland, Franks, of course France, Lombards, Italy, de Suvi, Portugal, Visigoths, Spain, Vandals destroyed, and the Ostrogoths were destroyed, and the Heruli were destroyed. So in history, what is known is this. There were six tribes in Europe that were Aryan in beliefs, which means they did not believe in the Trinity of the Godhead. This means they did not believe that Jesus was divine. The papacy did believe that Jesus was divine and set the papacy against those who did not believe the same way. There were three Aryan tribes which actively opposed the papacy. These were the Heruli, the Vandals, and of course the Ostrogoths. The most of the Heruli were Aryan. It appears from history that some of them were more pro-Catholic in beliefs. The Heruli in Rome were Aryan and were used as imperial guards until they revolted against Rome. The emperor was Romulus Augustus in 476 A.D., and they made Odoacer their king. To learn more about, you can learn more about that by doing your own search. History generally considers this act to have ended the Roman Empire officially. He remained king until 493 when the Ostrogoths installed their own king, Theodoric the Great, on the throne of Rome by deposing and killing Odoacer when they invaded Italy at the request of Zeno, who wanted to get the Heruli and their king out of the way because he felt that they were a threat to his authority in Rome. But of course the Ostrogoths were Aryan believers, so this also posed a problem for the Pope since he was under the Emperor's control. At this time it seems the Heruli disappeared from history of Rome because their tribal groups in Italy and Austria were destroyed by the Ostrogoths under Theodoric as they invaded Italy. As a people, the remaining Heruli disappeared altogether from history about 550 AD when the Lombards destroyed them during their invasion that eventually led them right into Italy. The removal of the Heruli from Rome in 493 AD solved the problem for the Pope, but the coming of the Ostrogoths to replace the Heruli created another problem for the Pope that remained until March of 538 AD and was solved by Justinian through Belisarius. The Vandals were destroyed on the order of Justinian, who had his capital at Constantinople. He sent his general Belisarius after the Vandals in North Africa in 533 AD. By 534, they were either dead, dispersed, or removed, so they were never heard from again in history. The Ostrogoths were a Germanic tribe, of which there were several, that moved into Italy and eventually took over Rome. The Ostrogoths remained in Rome until December 536 AD, at which time they left when Belisarius, under the orders from Justinian, came and entered the city of Rome. The Ostrogoths felt they could not successfully defend Rome against the siege, so they voluntarily left. A few months later, they returned for a year-long siege of Rome, not leaving until March of 538 AD. By the spring of 538, Roman laws under the government Justinian were once again ruling the ruling force in Rome, and it was then also possible for the Pope to enforce the decree of Justinian written in 533 AD. It was this event which marks the 1260-year time span mentioned in Daniel 7, times, time, and half a time. And since prophetic time is 360 days and symbolic for a year, this makes 1260 years. The Visigoths, which were another branch of the Goths, hung on in Spain for about another 50 years, but eventually they fell too and were absorbed into the Catholic system that lasted until Napoleon. And I believe that we have enough evidence there that, you know, if you want to search these things out further for yourself, it certainly is interesting to get into it. A little more information here. Justinian wrote the decree in 533 AD, in which he stated that the Pope was supreme bishop over all other bishops, and too had the power to suppress heresy. But it doesn't take a genius to realize that this was not enforceable when written because Justinian did not rule Rome. And we covered all of that, so no need to go further into that. And a lot of this you can learn from the Roman Catholic Encyclopedia itself is where we get a lot of these references, as well as other sources for history, but it is all history. So we move on back to our context, our text in the scripture, and we're in Daniel chapter 7. And verse 8. And he says, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn. You know, I was going to comment here. We have the horns, and this other one is called the little horn. It's called a talking horn. And another reason why it would be referred to as a little horn, whereas the other horns, their territory is huge by comparison. This little horn has a very little territory, even though it has a huge voice. Okay, and of course the little territory would be the seat of the papacy in Rome, which would be the Vatican, a very small territory. So that would be another reason that would be referred to as little, as we can use the comparison principle there, as compared to the other horns, which had much larger territories. And says, before whom were three of the first beasts plucked up by the roots, and we discussed that in depth there. And behold, this horn were given eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. And of course, in the Revelation, the word great things and blasphemies is added, so we find out more of the characteristics of this beast. Eyes like a man, that means that this power, this little horn, referring to the papacy, is given the eyes like a man, and it has a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. So we know that it has a representative that is like a man, and it speaks, and it certainly does speak, where none of the other horns are said to speak. So we see a difference there between this horn and the other horns. And I beheld until the thrones were cast down. And there's a sweeping thing, something, until the thrones were cast down. What thrones? Of course, all of these thrones, since it's not specifically, he's not specifically here referring to any particular throne. So I beheld till the thrones were cast down. This would also coincide to the time of the image dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and that was recorded there for us in chapter 2, where this great mountain, the kingdom of God, strikes the image in the feet. So we're down in the feet when we're talking about the fourth beast here, and then the ten horns and everything that happened after that. We're talking about the time when the image is struck in the feet. So the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. Of course, it doesn't take too much to figure out who this is referring to. His throne was like a fiery flame, and his wheels as a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were open. In verse 11, and I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body was destroyed. So we see the judgment coming from the Ancient of Days. Of course, this would be Yahshua, the King of Kings, sitting, and all of these other thrones are cast down, just as when the great mountain, the kingdom of God, struck the image of the feet, that all of these, the kingdoms that went before, were totally obliterated, and they became like the chaff of the threshing floor, and they were blown away so that no place was found for them anymore. So we have this succession principle where all of these things are done away with, and this kingdom that is coming up, and it fills the whole earth. So we're getting more details of what went before in the Nebuchadnezzar's dream and the interpretation given by Daniel, recorded there in chapter 2 of Daniel. So he says, I beheld until the beast was slain, and his body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. And of course, the beast is that fourth beast, exceeding dreadful and terrible. And so what was left of it, you know, basically, in all the divisions of it, by the heads and the horns, it was destroyed. The body was destroyed, and it was given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. And I need a little more insight into that, so something that I'm going to look into and study a little bit more today, if I can, there in Daniel 7, chapter 12, as concerning the rest of the beasts. They had their dominion taken away. So as we see that the dominion is destroyed, the rulership is destroyed, but this Roman image, the beast, is totally consumed by the fire. And we'll be back after the break. Don't go anywhere.
That trouble me. Many are they that rise up against me. Many are they that say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and lifter of my head. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and lifter of my head.
Sometimes our .com server goes down, so don't forget, we have a backup, firstamendmentradio.net. Hi, Nicholas here. I used to lug those big jugs to the market to fill with water from those coin-operated filter machines, 25 cents a gallon or 5 gallons for a buck. I used to. Then I got the big Berkey. Now I saved my back and hundreds of dollars, too. I was paying $600 for the same 3,000 gallons of water that a pair of black Berkey filters will provide for my own tap for only $99. This means that your Berkey water system will entirely pay for itself with only 1,500 gallons of use, and then you will still have 1,500 gallons left before you need to replace the filters. Do the math. Stop throwing your money away on bottled water and filter dispensers that may or may not be delivering as promised. For a limited time,
First Amendment Radio is offering 10% off on the most popular Berkey water systems. Visit the shopping page at firstamendmentradio.com or call us at 559-781-3773 for more information. Leave your name and address and we'll send you this special offer. Do it now. First Amendment Radio is an authorized distributor of Berkey products.
Now you can enjoy the most delicious, freshest, and healthiest drinking water anytime, even while traveling, during outdoor sporting activities, and in hospital filtration environments such as local or national emergencies. The revolutionary Berkey Light removes pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, and harmful or unwanted chemicals to below detectable levels. It also removes foul tastes and odors like that rotten egg smell of sulfide, and it reduces nitrates and unhealthy minerals like lead and mercury while leaving in the healthful and nutritional minerals your body needs. The Berkey Light is so powerful it can purify raw, untreated water from remote lakes, streams, and stagnant ponds. The Berkey Light is transparent and glows in the dark with its rechargeable LED lighting system, so it can be used as a night light or camp light.
Get the Berkey Light Purifier today by calling First Amendment Radio at 559-781-3773. That's 559-781-3773. Or order on the web at firstamendmentradio.com. Not yet available in Iowa.
Collapsing was much softer, still falling always hurt. Only after sensing love for always ever burned. Justified my folly, my affluent disguise, rule revealing nothing, nothing unforgiven lies.
You're listening to Cross the Border. My website is crosstheborder.org. If you've missed any of these studies in Daniel, you can find there the last 5 days' worth of studies. This one will be up in 3-4 hours, something like that. It'll go up, so you can listen to that. But if you missed the last 2 days, we're talking about the principles for interpretation of the beasts and other symbols in Daniel and Revelation. And here we're applying those principles to Daniel and chapter 7. And it's making a lot more sense than, what is generally passed off as prophecy out there and with the futurist interpretation. Daniel continues here, and it's recorded for us in chapter 7 and verse 13. He says, "I saw in the night vision, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages would serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed." It doesn't take a whole lot of interpretation there to figure out what's going on. And that's why I always say his kingdom, that, you know, that we need to cross the border into his kingdom. It's the only kingdom that will last forever, as it says here and recorded by Daniel. He is given an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom which shall not be destroyed. That means never. And Daniel goes, "And I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. And I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the four beasts, which were all diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured in broken pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. And of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn which had the eyes and mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. And I beheld the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Daniel's giving us a little more detail here. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth. So is there a fifth kingdom upon the earth? No, there isn't. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. So we use this progression principle that we spoke of. When Rome arose, it was the body of the beast. And then after it, in the spirit of Rome, we had the heads and the horns that came up after it. And it said, and this one was diverse, of course. So he goes, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth. So there's no other great kingdom that comes after that. A lot of people mistakenly believe that this Antichrist power is going to rise up and we're going to have a one world government. Well, the one world government that we're going to have is already here. And here it is. We've been reading about it. It's the fourth kingdom upon the earth. And we've read about the divisions of the heads and the horns. Daniel continues here. It shall be diverse from all kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And that has been going on, and it's still going on. We can see here in America, definitely Roman. And part of America is now starting, is a beast that rises up out of the earth. Spoken of in Revelation, that had lamb-like qualities, but then it changes and it speaks like a dragon. We have that progression principle. First, it rises up and it has lamb-like qualities. Secondly, it speaks like a dragon, which means that it starts to create laws that persecutes the saints of God. That's what it means to speak like a dragon. And we'll get into that when we get into Revelation. We'll discuss these principles and how they apply to the symbols and the beasts and so forth in the book of Revelation. But still, that is part of this last kingdom that comes alongside the first beast. It says, the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High. We get a little more detail. He just spoke great things at first, Daniel tells us, but now we get more interpretation. He speaks against the Most High. And he shall wear out the saints of the Most High. And he shall think to change times and laws. Where did we get the calendar that we follow today? And the week, the times. He changed the times. He changed the year. The year that from the Creator's calendar goes back to the beginning from Adam, from the creation itself. That's the beginning. And anyone looking at the calendar with that year on it, they know automatically. But now we have a calendar that is called BC, AD, which has now become before the Common Era and the Common Era, BCE and CE. So it changed the times, and it doesn't go back to the beginning, to the creation. So that fits right in with the plans of the evil one, who wants us to believe in evolution, that we've been here for millions of years. However, if our calendar plainly stated that we've only been here approximately 6,000 years, then everyone would know. There wouldn't be no BCE and CE and all of that stuff. Also, he changed not only the times of the years, but he changed the times of the day. We now begin our day in the middle of the night when there is nothing going on. We begin in the middle of a cycle where the Creator gave us cycles to begin and end the day, and he gave us cycles to begin and end the month, and he also gave us a cycle to begin and end the year. None of those being applied anymore because of the decrees. He also changed the Sabbath from the seventh day of Yahuwah's calendar, the Creator's calendar, to Sunday of his own calendar, so that now the Sabbath is on Sunday by the decree of the little horn. So he speaks great things. He changed times and he changed law. He also changed the law of God. The Ten Commandments have been changed by the Pope and by the seat of the Pope, the Vatican. So the times and laws were changed there. The law one law being the Sabbath law, of course, and of course the other Ten Commandments, they had to remove one commandment and split another commandment in two so that they'd still have ten. So you can look into that if you do a search on the difference between the Ten Commandments from the Bible and the Ten Commandments according to Catholic law. And it says, "And they shall be given into his hand until a time, and the dividing of a time," which basically here is concerning a 360-day year would be 1,260 years. If you go a time is 1 year, times is 2 years, and a half a time, which would be the 1,260 years. But the judgment shall sit, so now we're progressing here, but the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it till the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. So that we're getting a picture of what is to come and what is developing, what will be the culmination of these events. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. And that ends Daniel chapter 7. So we move on to Daniel chapter 8. And he continues here, in the third year, and I don't know how much time has lapsed between this vision of Daniel chapter 7 and the third year. Okay, well, we have the third year, so we have a couple years here. I mean, it's plainly there. So to ask the question and have it answered immediately, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. So we had the first year, Belshazzar, one vision, and the third year, we have another vision. He says, "This vision appeared to me, even to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. And when I lifted up my eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him." So we know that the ram is a beast, and referring to other beasts, were whatever kingdoms or nations that he went out to war with. None stood before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will, and he became great. And I guess there the operative word would be great. because here speaking, of course, of the Medes and the Persians. And I was considering this, and behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came up, and he came to the ram that had two horns, which had been standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with anger against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great. So we have great, and then we have very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken, for it came up, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And we see the parallels here with the beasts of chapter 7. And out of the one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceedingly great toward the north, toward the south, east, and toward the pleasant land, and waxed great even unto the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. And here we see the word stamped upon, one of the characteristics. And he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. So we know that in succession he came to the prince of the host. And of course that is a reference to the Messiah. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. Of course we're talking about Rome. And this, the stamping, is that's what the Rome did. And he magnified himself to the prince of the hosts, and that was to the Messiah when he was crucified. And by him the daily was taken away, in a reference to the place of the sanctuary was cast down, the destruction of the temple. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of the transgression. And he came, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and it prospered. Okay, then he goes on, it practiced and it prospered. Then I heard one of the saints speaking, and another saint said to that certain saint which spoke, how long shall the vision concerning the daily... So we have a shift here. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said to that certain saint. So after he sees the things, now he sees two holy people. The word saint here, of course, now let's take a look at it. It means a sacred or an angel or a holy one. So we don't know specifically who is speaking here, but he sees in a vision, and he hears one of these holy ones speaking to another one. And it said, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the daily, and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? That's interesting. It seems there's a shift here. And we're gonna go through all of this tomorrow in great detail. And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now this here is there is a lot of speculation and a lot of different views on what this happens, how this happens. Now a lot of people believe that the 2,300 days are to be, as with the other prophecies given in Daniel, we have the weeks, the 77s given by Daniel. And then we have the 1260, or the times, time, and the time times and half a time given, which refers to years. Basically, we have that adds up in history, and we see how it's played out. But in neither of those is the term days used, but the term is the time, times, and half a times. So it doesn't specifically say days, whereas here it actually uses in the Hebrew the word for, and I'm trying to get my mouse over to do this, it says day or dusk or night, but here it's using the word days, 2,300 days. So there's something different, and we have here a differentiation. So can we apply a principle here between this prophecy and the times given, between the other prophecies? Perhaps we can. Many people don't. Many people want to say that these days actually do represent years. And we're going to discuss this in detail tomorrow and try to ferret out which one of these interpretations fit and how we should interpret this using the principles given, and whether there's a principle here that's not being applied by many people. Because he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Okay, preceding that, he says, how long shall the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? So we have something that's trodden underfoot. And of course, the daily is talking about the sacrificed. How long shall it be trodden underfoot? That's the question. And the to give the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot. Who is the host? Of course, the host would be the people of God, would it not? So we're talking about the national Israel, or what's left of it, of course, because we're talking about the sanctuary or the host of the sanctuary. So there's a lot of things that we need to take into consideration here. And it came to pass when I, in verse 15, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. So he's saying that a man stood before me, but something about this man let me know that he was only appearing as a man, that there was something different about this man. And I heard the man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which, and that's the river, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where he stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. So we're talking about the vision, but when these two saints appear, they're also talking about the vision. So what the saints are talking about is not the vision itself. So I think we need to differentiate there and, you know, try to apply all of these rules. So Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where he stood, and when he came, he says, I was afraid, I fell upon my face. And he said to me, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. And of course, shall be is added, but, and of course, the end of what? Of course, now what is Daniel concerned about this whole time? He's concerned about the people of God. And he continues, now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. The ram which you saw having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. So we get it clearly here now, who they are. I mean, it couldn't be clearer than this. We're being precisely told who they are. And the rough coat is the king of Greece, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Of course, that would be Alexander the Great. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, so we're still in their kingdom of the four, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. So we're absolutely talking about Rome, or that fourth beast. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and holy people. So we see the progression going on here. And we've just run out of time. So we're going to pick this back up, and we're going to tear Daniel chapter 8 apart tomorrow. So don't miss that.
Let down your hair, let our kiss make fools of.